Well, this is the next to the last week of our series on managing conflict. We've been taking lessons from the Bible on how to handle disputes that come up in our lives. And we've said so far that, you know, sometimes we may be a little too quick to defend our position when there's a disagreement. Instead, what we really need to do more of, as hard as it is to take an interest in the other person's viewpoint. And you know, to help with that, a simple question like, you know, can you tell me more about what you're thinking? That can diffuse a situation and help you find common ground. We've also covered a few traps that you definitely don't want to get into during a conflict. For example, we said you should go to the other party directly and avoid gossiping about the situation. Gossip might feel good in the moment, but it never helps and it often makes things worse. Another trap that most of us struggle with is, you know, attributing bad motives or malicious intentions to people who have hurt us. We assume that they meant to hurt us, when instead what we should do is just assume that they had good intentions but just disagree with us. And then last week we talked about how to persevere with love during a stubborn and deep-rooted conflict that just won't go away. You know, something that, a conflict that you just have over and over again with somebody, maybe somebody close in your life, like a spouse or a parent or a sibling. And what we said about that is we must never give up on the other person. Sometimes you may have to put up some boundaries to protect yourself, but never give up on the other person. Trust in God and hope for a better future with that person. The goal of every conflict really should be reconciliation. And so one part of that is an apology. That process of reconciliation usually starts with an apology. So we also talked about how to sincerely apologize and how to avoid apologies that are, you know, begrudging or passive aggressive or conditional or filled with excuses. Good apologies, we said, don't try to shift the blame to the other person. They take ownership of the problem, they show remorse, and they try to make amends. But, of course, there are two sides to reconciliation. There's an apology, but then there's a second requirement. You also need forgiveness. And that's what we're going to talk about this week, forgiveness. A few years ago, I went to SeaWorld with my family in Florida. I loved Shamu, you know, the whale, and that was great. But what I really was fascinated by were the pink flamingos. You see, flamingos are social birds. They live together in colonies numbering in the thousands. But if you watch the pink flamingos closely, as I did, you'll notice that when one flamingo gets in the way of another one, he just pushes him out of the way with his beak. And he does it rather forcefully. It's not nice. And I saw this over and over again. And as I watched this periodic, you know, violent behavior, I was expecting to see some sort of flamingo fight club breakout. But each time, nothing happened. The moment passed and both birds just kept going about their business as if nothing had happened. And I thought to myself, what would happen if I did that to one of the thousands of tourists darting across my path and getting in my way that day at SeaWorld? What if I, you know, just shoved one of them out of the way, right? You've been to amusement parks, so tempting, right? But I knew what would happen. Words would be exchanged, epithets hurled, and then I would be escorted out, either by security or on a stretcher. You see, unlike jostled flamingos, human beings don't let things go so easily. We are quickly offended, and we have a hard time forgiving and moving on. But despite how difficult it is, we all know that we should forgive. For one thing, it's good for you. It's good for you. If you don't believe me, just Google the words forgiveness and health. World-renowned institutions like the Johns Hopkins Medical Institute and the Mayo Clinic have conducted numerous studies on the topic, and it turns out that forgiving lowers anxiety and stress. People who intentionally exhibit forgiveness have lower blood pressures and are less likely to suffer from depression. They have a stronger immune system and have a meaningfully lower risk of a heart attack. I guess there's a lot of truth to the old saying that refusing to forgive is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. The second reason that we should forgive is that the Bible tells us we have to, and that's the most important reason of all. In the Gospel of Mark, Jesus says, "Forgive anyone against whom you have a grievance, so that your heavenly Father may in turn forgive you." Did you catch that? It's the same thing we ask God when we pray the Our Father. Forgive us for our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us, which really means forgive us because we forgive others. Or you could say it a different way. You could say it like this: God, please don't forgive us if we don't forgive others. In short, as Jesus said in the gospel today, what we dole out to others is what we're going to get back from God. So that's a really good reason to forgive. But there's still a third reason to forgive, and this one might change your whole way of thinking about forgiveness. Let me explain. Forgiveness is hard because we usually think of it as giving something to someone who really doesn't deserve it. You see, the word forgiveness literally means to give up something, like losing money by forgiving a debt, right? You give up the money that you're owed. And in a conflict, that forgiveness would mean giving up the desire or the power to punish someone for hurting you. It would be a decision to let go of revenge. In other words, we usually think of forgiveness as kind of a sacrifice on our part. And to many people, that just doesn't seem right when it was the other person who was clearly at fault. We often falsely believe that holding on to a grudge is a way of holding on to power. That was especially true in the time of Jesus. The culture then emphasized honor and shame. It was crucially important to hold on to honor and never be shamed. And when you were wronged by someone, a refusal to forgive that person was seen as a form of power, of holding on to your honor, a way to hold the wrongdoer accountable. He now owes you something. Forgiveness was seen as weak, an inability to protect your honor, and even a lack of loyalty to your family. But Jesus challenged these cultural assumptions. In the gospel story this week, he continues his three-part sermon. It's almost like he was doing a message series, just saying. Anyway, the message today is pretty clear. Love your enemies and forgive those who hurt you. Do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. This was completely unheard of. It was an insane, revolutionary idea. Jesus gives several examples of behavior that might seem weak, like turning the other cheek or handing over more to someone who steals from you, but in truth is actually showing incredible strength. It's really a matter of refusing to be conquered by evil and instead conquering evil with good. That's why forgiveness is not a weakness. It's a strength. Because forgiveness is a power that belongs uniquely to God. And God is all powerful. And when we forgive, we are imitating God's power. And as St. Paul says in the second reading, we are bearing the image of the Heavenly One when we forgive. When Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead, he told them that they too have this power even while they're on earth. He says, if you forgive anyone's sins, their sins are forgiven. If you do not forgive them, they are not forgiven. That's power. David exercised that kind of power in the first reading today. It's a great story. I don't know if you caught it all, but you know, King Saul was the first king of Israel, and he was a good king until he went insane. And he went insane because he was jealous of David. David did everything better, and he was jealous. And so King Saul started hunting down David. And so David was on the run. He was a fugitive. And one night, he and his men stumble across Saul's camp, and everyone is sleeping. David could have easily solved his problem right then and there. He could have chosen the false power of revenge and retribution. It's not what he did. He took Saul's spear, and he took his water jug, and he went a safe distance across the valley, and he woke Saul up to tell him he had forgiven him. Here's what he says: "Today, though the Lord delivered you into my grasp, I would not harm the Lord's anointed," meaning the king. When he forgave Saul, David was the one with the real power. You see, when you forgive someone, the balance of power shifts to you. You are no longer the victim because you get to choose what the future looks like. Well, those are all good reasons to forgive, and I'm getting a lot of amens out there from the dog, so it sounds like a great homily. Anyway, those are all good reasons to forgive, but it still leaves open the question, how do you forgive? How do you go about forgiving? It's a really hard thing to do. Well, the first thing to know is that forgiveness is not a feeling. It's a choice. It's an act of the will. You know, on Christmas Eve, I told you about a remarkable woman named Corrie ten Boom, who lived in Holland during World War II. Corrie and her family helped nearly 800 Jews escape from Hitler's regime. But then one day, their home was raided, and the Gestapo arrested the entire family. Corrie and her sister were sent to a terrible concentration camp called Ravensbrück, where her sister died, but Corrie was eventually released through a clerical error. I told you all that on Christmas Eve, but that's not where the story ends. After the war, Corrie traveled around the world giving speeches on forgiveness. And after one of those talks, a man came up to her. She immediately recognized him as one of the cruelest guards at that concentration camp. And all the shame and all the suffering came rushing back to her in an instant. The man told her that he was a former guard, but then after the war had become a Christian. And then he stretched out his hand and he asked her for forgiveness. For what seemed like an eternity, Corrie fumbled with her purse, stalling for time. She knew she had to do it. She had seen firsthand how those who could not forgive remained locked in a prison cell of anger and bitterness. And so Corrie eventually reached out and took his hand, at first woodenly, mechanically, and without feeling. She said it was the most difficult thing she ever had to do. She literally forced herself to do it. It was an act of sheer will. But then, something incredible happened. "The current started in my shoulder," she said. "It raced down my arm, sprang into our joined hands, and then this healing warmth seemed to flood my whole body, bringing tears to my eyes. I forgive you, brother," she cried out, "with all my heart." Corrie said that she had never known God's love so much as in that moment. This man she was forgiving was complicit in the ruthless torture and death of countless innocent people. And of course, she didn't want to forgive him. I think that's a big mistake we all make sometimes. We think we are supposed to want to forgive someone. When people hurt you, you will almost never want to forgive them. But you can. It's an act of the will. And like with an apology, there's a right way and a wrong way to forgive. The wrong way expects the other person to grovel. The wrong way judges the sincerity of an apology. "I don't think that was sincere enough. You want to try it again?" the wrong way rubs the other person's nose in it and warns about future infractions. Well, I forgive you, but that better not happen again. The right way to forgive is unconditional. It assumes the best of intentions. It does not care how many times forgiveness have been given in the past. It does not brood on the injury or harbor resentment. It also tries to rebuild trust in the relationship. See, there's two steps. Forgiveness is an act of the will. Rebuilding trust takes time. And that's where the feelings eventually follow. Several years ago, I had an embarrassing experience. The pastor of the parish here, before I became pastor, he hosted a dinner party for other priests in the area. And I sat down on my chair, as everyone else did, and within seconds, it crumbled beneath me. I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but it's quite embarrassing. I went down hard, and everybody at the table just laughed their heads off. They thought it was the funniest thing they'd ever seen, but I was mortified. Well, the next day, the pastor called me over and he proudly showed me the chair that he had super glued together again. And he said, "Look, Roger, it's as good as new. Why don't you give it a try?" Do you think I would ever sit on that chair again? My mother didn't raise no fool. Restoring trust is hard, even if it's just in a chair. Because the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. Forgiveness can never undo what happened in the past. It will never restore the old relationship just as it was. And that's especially true if there was some abuse or serious mental illness. In those cases, you can still forgive, but you have to put up some boundaries. But in most cases, forgiveness can forge a new relationship that is often stronger than the old one if both parties are willing to do the hard work of rebuilding trust. Think of it this way. It's like when Jesus rose from the dead. His body was changed. It was glorified. It was brilliant. It was perfect. I don't know. It was bejeweled, sparkling. I'm not sure. One day I'll see, I hope. But however glorified his body is, it still has the wounds of his betrayal. The nail marks on his hands and feet, the laceration in his sides, in his side, those wounds will be there forever. They are the eternal signs of the divine power of forgiveness. And for 20 centuries, for more than 20 centuries, the man that people look at and say, "That is weak," billions of people have knelt before that man who still bears those wounds of forgiveness. That's what rebuilding trust is all about. There's a beautiful song from the play Hamilton. It takes place shortly after Alexander Hamilton's life has unraveled. He's been unfaithful to his wife. He's been kicked out of the American political elite. He told his son to take part in a duel, and as a result, his son died. Can you imagine? All that shame coming at him all at once. And after all that, he moved uptown in New York City and he asked his wife, Eliza, a person of devout Christian faith, if she would just go on a walk with him. And on that walk, we hear a beautiful, moving song about forgiveness. It's called "It's Quiet Uptown." I asked the choir to sing it tonight, but they need to brush up on their rap. So what I'm going to ask you to do is go home tonight. It's actually not a rap song. It's a beautiful song. Go home tonight and YouTube it. It's called "It's Quiet Uptown" from the play Hamilton. The first time I heard it, I felt deep in my bones that I understood better the true divine power of forgiveness. And when you listen to it, I want you to think of a relationship in your life right now that may be struggling, that's maybe you've got some hurt around all that. And I just want you to ask yourself this question. Will you choose to forgive that person? Will you work to rebuild trust? It is your choice. You determine the future. The power is yours.